From the Sky News Centre at 6, Theresa May spent the afternoon filling the vacancies in her cabinet caused by yesterday's resignations. Relatively unknown Stephen Barclay, who was a junior health minister, is her surprising choice as Brexit secretary. Meanwhile, Amber Rudd's back in government taking charge of work and pensions. She's urging MPs to think again if they're planning to challenge the Prime Minister's position.
This is not a time for changing our leader. This is a time for pulling together, for making sure that we remember who we are here to serve, who we are here to help. That's the whole of the country. And I worry sometimes that my colleagues are too concerned about the Westminster bubble.
But many Tories have sent letters calling for a vote of no confidence. Six men have been jailed for up to 23 years each for grooming and sexually abusing vulnerable teenage girls in Rotherham. A judge told them they coerced and intimidated the victims after plying them with alcohol and drugs. Police are blaming dissident Republicans for leaving bullets and pipe bombs close to a boiler in an outhouse at a property in West Belfast. They were only discovered after emergency services put out a fire there. Virgin Media is to appeal against a £7 million fine for overcharging customers who left contracts early. The firm says the penalty isn't justified or reasonable. Claudio Ranieri says the death of Leicester owner Wichai Siawatahanaprava is still unbelievable. The Italian guided the club to the 2016 Premier League title while working under the late Thai businessman. Ranieri says he travelled in the helicopter which crashed many times himself.
Wichai made a fantastic thing, not only win the Premier League, but what he did in the city with the people, with the fans. For everybody, he has a big heart, and when I think how many times I take the helicopter, it's unbelievable.
And the men's magazine shortlist is no longer going to be printed. Its publisher is axing the free edition, but it will continue online. That's the latest. I'm Barry Weir.
Love Bristol. Love BCFM 93.2.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news is Green Councillor for Clifton, Jerome Thomas. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, well, as you might have noticed, there's not a lot of broadcasters or newspapers in Bristol that cover national and international news. It's all done from London. So there's not many places you'll hear this sort of thing in this city. Why is that, by the way? Germany, almost every city's got its own national and international newspaper. Every major city anyway. Anyway, after the 7 o'clock news, Israel's intelligence, security and transport minister, Israel Katz, says he's building a high-speed rail link to Oman. We hear his views, though, tonight on relations with Iran in our occasional series, Getting to Know the Israeli Cabinet. And what is he doing as an intelligence and transport minister? Why the two together? Sure, Martin Summers will have something to tell us about that. And drone wars. It's revealed this week that the UK is funding autonomous killer drone research. What about hacking airliners full of passengers, effectively turning them into drones themselves? And cars are even easier. Plus, the CIA has even admitted it's looking into doing just that, to assassinate people. So we look at hacking and drones tonight. And if you haven't seen Vaxxed, the movie, it's not available without paying for it, so you have to pay to watch it. It's about how the pharmaceutical industry has taken over large parts of the drug regulation committees in Europe and the United States and around the world, and is increasingly deciding our policy, the pharmaceutical industry. You should have watched it, Why have drug companies cancelled clinical tests on combining different vaccinations into one? And why do our national press still talk about Dr. Andrew Wakefield, who says he's proven links between MMR and autism, as discredited, while so much of the attack on his research has been thrown out in the courts here in Britain? Also, author of The Secret College, William Stewart again, on the origins of Zionism and the setting up of a Western fortress to take over the Middle East. Plus, Martin Summers gets his chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after seven. Well, now, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 9 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs around 11 Celsius. Sunny intervals and a moderate breeze. Sounds like it's going to be dry. Next week, highs of 7 Celsius, partly cloudy, getting cold, isn't it? But with some patchy rain. Next weekend, that's the 24th and 25th of November, highs of 7 Celsius, mainly cloudy. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is Green Councillor for Clifton, Jerome Thomas. Hi, Jerome. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony.
Do you want to take us through what's been going on with Brexit this week? We know we've had the statement by the Prime Minister, this so-called deal, a big fanfare. Several cabinet ministers have decided they're not interested. What do you make of it all?
Well, I mean, you might say that if you've got Brexiteers resigning and you've got Remainers resigning, that she might have done what is the sort of the middle path. And you'd probably also say that you've got a Labour Party that's as equally divided as the Conservative Party on Brexit. So I'm not sure that a general election would solve anything.
So what would you have been doing if you'd been sitting in the cabinet? I mean, I can't imagine you quite sitting down at the cabinet with Theresa May, but if you were, would you be sticking with this deal? Do you think it's worthwhile? Because it's the temptation, isn't it? And I think this is something Jeremy Corbyn, a trap he's fallen into. It's just because you're in the opposition and you want a general election, you're going to attack what Theresa May's doing, whatever it is.
Well, I'm a Remainer, but I also recognise that 52% of the population voted to leave. There's the three choices, really, as it looks at the moment. There's Remain, there's hard Brexit, and there is this soft Brexit, which is kind of Theresa May's deal. And either Parliament will work that through, one of those, or those choices need to get put to the electorate in a people's vote, kind of second referendum.
Parliament won't vote this through, though, will they? It's almost certain that Theresa May is short of at least 140 MPs to get it passed.
Well, it depends what happens with the Labour Party. If, in terms of the tests that the Labour Party was setting out, what Theresa May has come up with, you might argue, satisfies the Labour Party's tests. So you might well see quite a few Labour MPs voting for Theresa May's deal.
Martin Summers, staying in the customs union for this transition period, but making it indefinite. I mean, it could drag on for years and years, couldn't it?
Well, it's obviously a fudge. I think it's not true. I think some Labour MPs will vote for the deal, but I don't think. I think the general consensus across the party is to vote against it, just to to take the government down. And I think what I saw this week,
but that's not good for the country, is
well
it?
No, hang on a minute, we're talking about politics, Tony. Yeah. You know we don't have to do everybody's got their own interests, including the European Union, including the Irish government, for example.
But shouldn't the Labour MPs just be voting on their conscience as to what the people voted for?
We could have a free vote on it, but I don't think there's going to be one. People are going to be whipped on both sides, and the way it's shaped up, I think what Jeremy Corbyn's concession this week was, if we can't get a general election, then we're going to have to go for another referendum. And that might be winnable in terms of Tory Remainers agreeing with that view. It's going to be a roller coaster ride. The pound's already wobbling, and the economy's going to take a big hit.
I mean,
that's definitely
it does look as if. I mean, if she can't get this deal through, it's possible she'll be replaced. It doesn't look as if there's enough Tory MPs to do that at the moment. People often forget Theresa May was not elected as the leader of the Conservative Party. There was a competition and Andrea Leadsom fell on her sword. So Theresa May just took over this job, even though she was a Remainer originally. What do you make of the potential for a... I mean, it's looking more and more likely there's going to be no deal, Martin, isn't it?
I think that's that's definitely what the markets are smelling. And of course, once they really smell that, then there's going to be a run on the pound.
Why would there be? Because we're still going to be able to trade. It's just not.
But don't forget that the just-in-time production methods that are used in most of industry these days require frictionless trade. If you've got to have people stopping at the border to check everything, of course, the regulations. It's just the uncertainty associated with no deal. They're talking about WTO rules. Well, at the same time as they're talking about that, Donald Trump is basically smashing the WTO. So it's not even clear that WTO rules will apply. In which case, if you're an investor trying to run a business, you're going to move it to Poland or Austria or wherever else, and that's going to kick in, and it will kick in over time. But currency markets don't work like that. They discount the future. There'll be a run on the pound, which will cause an interest rates to rise and all sorts of problems associated with that.
So do you think Theresa May will survive, or will there be somebody else take over as Tory leader?
I think she's dead meat. She's finished.
But she's going to carry on unless there's enough MPs, like Jacob Rees-Mogg famously yesterday said he's putting in his little letter saying that he wants her replaced. There's not enough Tory MPs to do it.
Well, they need 48, I believe, to write a letter. I think that if things get more febrile, that's quite possible. But of course, a Tory election contest in the middle of this crisis is the last thing that the pound needs. And so we're going to, it's going to be hang on to your hats.
I mean, surely if that brings about a new Prime Minister who's got a bigger consensus within the Tory party, actually that's good for financial stability rather than this present situation.
No, it isn't, because the deal that's been offered by the EU is the final concessions they're going to make. So you can have a new Tory Prime Minister. It doesn't mean the 27 other European countries or the Irish government, which are key in all of this, but most people don't seem to realise, are not going to change their minds. And so no deal looms on March the 19th because the British decided that they wanted to start the clock. Nobody in the European Union said, well, let's not rush. But it's the British who rushed it. And, future historians are going to look at this and think, what on earth were they doing? But there you go.
Now, Jerome, I look at this as a genuine political drama, actually, that nobody really knows how it's going to work. And it's often a bit like that, isn't it? It's easy to get into a marriage, but not so easy to get out.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I do think that we'll either get a sort of minor variant of Theresa May's offer, or we'll have a second referendum. And if we have a second referendum, we need to have those three different choices on the ballot paper, and people need to be able to rank them with a single transferable vote. Because at the moment, you'd have, some Brexiteers in the media you've heard say, well, if I don't get a hard Brexit, I'd rather have Remain than what Theresa's offering. And some Remainers say, I'd rather have a hard Brexit than this soft Brexit. So it's an interesting number of alliances.
You couldn't make it up, could you?
Martin, why are you nodding there? Do you think that's actually likely that maybe there will be another referendum with a proper, as Jerome is saying there, a proper, mature, intelligent system for voting, like the single transferable vote? What does that mean for a start? It's just take us through that, the single transferable vote. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you just rank them in order of preference, which is what we should do at national elections,
actually,
and we don't.
We do something like that with the mayors, don't we, anyway?
Yes, yes, because the Tories wanted to push through having elected mayors, but they didn't have a mandate, they couldn't do anything. And that's true of national governments as well. In actual fact, that the present government doesn't, if you actually look at the vote, have a mandate to negotiate. And that's what makes it so tricky. Our political system is really under the microscope here, and it's basically a mess and has been for donkey's years. It's not a new thing. Don't forget, Sinn Féin don't take their seats. If they did, the government would be out and we wouldn't be talking about any of this.
What about what would happen financially if we did crash out without a deal? And that certainly looks as if Theresa May stays at the moment. I mean, it seems as if what's going to happen is they're going to go through this sort of strange ritual of having this vote in the House of Commons, which they're going to fail. So, but what would happen if we do crash out, Martin?
The dangers are that up to now, the markets, and don't get me wrong, I'm no fan of the international currency markets. They're a menace to humanity, but they're there. And they exist, and they've got an awful lot of power. And if it looks as if it's going to be, this kind of car crash scenario, then investors will just take flight. And I feel like saying to Jacob Rees-Mogg, who in his other manifestation is a hedge fund manager, he's got Somerset Capital, what's it called? Somerset Capital Asset Management, SCAM, is his company. And of course, what will be happening is, are you selling the pound because everybody else is? And you say, well, of course I'm selling the pound because everybody else is. But you're selling the pound because by selling the pound, you're communicating that Brexit is going to be a failure. That's what that means. When the first vote went through, the pound lost 20% of its value, and all sorts of problems started to emerge in the economy, which were latent. And if we're going to have a no-deal Brexit, the pound will take a hammering, which means interest rates will have to rise, which means the house market's going to collapse, which means that people are going to lose their jobs, the car industry is going to go. Maybe we'll have to have a hard Brexit so that people who said they wanted it have to live through the consequences of what democratic decisions mean for adults.
Dominic Raab resigning this week, Jerome. I mean, it really does seem as if right at the very heart of this negotiation is someone that never really believed in it in the first place.
Yeah, I'm not quite clear what the reasons were for his resignation. It seems to be something to do with the Irish backstop. But I don't have a clear enough understanding of what was motivating him.
Martin, what do you think? I mean, he's obviously not. Doesn't back this deal.
Well, I mean, in theory, he was the guy who negotiated this deal. But I understand in practice the deal was negotiated by civil servants reporting directly to the Prime Minister. And basically, none of the Brexiteers want to take responsibility for the car crash they've created.
That would explain why Michael Gove apparently yesterday said, oh, I don't mind being Brexit Secretary, but I need to be in charge of the negotiations. You think he's probably aware that hasn't been the case?
Yeah, but the negotiations on this phase are over. The EU27, Angela Merkel made it absolutely clear we're not renegotiating anything now. This is the deal. You take it or leave it. And if you don't take it, then it's no deal. But of course, in the future, you may reapply.
Hasn't it occurred to the Merkel and the rest of them that maybe this deal is not going to get through the British Parliament anyway? Well, I suppose they're wringing their hands, saying this is a right disaster for the Brits.
Well, no. The point is, they basically got a million other things to think about: the war in Ukraine, all the people flooding over the Mediterranean, etc.
Look, Martin, let's not detract from how important this is, because there are a lot of other countries, particularly in southern Europe, the populations actually, if they were given a vote, would have voted to leave the EU. So the EU have got to really make sure that it doesn't send a signal, Brexit, to other countries, to the populations, that, okay, it's time to get out of the EU.
Well, what may happen as a result, partly of Brexit, partly of the standoff between the Italian government and the European Central Bank, partly because Greece is still not fixed, Spain isn't fixed, the economy in Germany is going down the drain, is that the EU will unravel in a disorderly fashion with Brexit as one of the triggers. But that won't be any good for anybody in Europe. I tell you who wants that to happen? Donald Trump. That's what he's up for. Uh-huh. He wants to see the EU smashed so that he can deal individually with individual countries who will be in a much weaker position than a trading bloc like the EU.
At the moment, it looks like Brexit is going to be a disaster of some sort, whatever sort, and it's going to be sending a signal to all these other countries, well, maybe actually getting out of the EU isn't such a good idea.
I think you're exaggerating the desire to leave the EU in other countries. No. The Greeks, for example, when they were put down
Italy,
to...
Italy and Greece would definitely vote out if they were given a chance.
The case.
Yes, it is the case.
No, it is the case. Well, actually, if they were given the vote, Tony, I think you're exaggerating this.
Italy would be out tomorrow. No. Out of the EU, if they were given
half
a chance.
All right, we're disagreeing about a matter of fact of speculation. In actual fact, it's about the euro, what they're talking about, and the European Central Bank. It's not about the EU.
So you're conflating two separate things. But they're not allowed to even have their own economic policies at all.
No, that's the European Central Bank and being in the euro. We're not in the euro, yeah?
Yes, but the two parties are Eurosceptic parties ruling Italy, and they were just been voted in this year.
Yeah, but
Euroscepticism
in this country didn't mean leaving the EU. It meant being hostile to EU policy.
Well, we found out that's not true a couple of years ago. Anyway, Jerome, at the end of the day, do you think Theresa May will still be here when it comes to next March, when we finally leave? Yeah. Okay. what about the Bristol point of view? Because we actually voted to remain, didn't we?
Yeah, I mean, but it's a national decision. So, you know, we can try and influence events, but ultimately it's a national decision.
Is there any kind of impact at all through the City Council? Is the City Council itself looking at how Brexit is going to affect Britain? Particularly, I suppose, if it's a disorderly Brexit and we just leave without a deal.
Well, whether it's a disorderly Brexit or an orderly Brexit, it's going to have an impact on the local economy. Most obviously, if it's a hard Brexit and you've got big manufacturing industry, and manufacturers will want to be integrated into the European market.
I suppose that Airbus will be packing their bags, quite possibly.
You would have thought so, yes.
Straight away. But there is another side to it, and that is that for small businesses, it might actually be better because it's difficult for to get imports to compete with local small businesses. So for the bigger businesses, I think they're probably going to be interested in staying in the EU. But for smaller businesses, there'll be a bigger market for them, potentially.
Can you explain
what I'm saying is for smaller businesses in the UK, say for example fruit sellers or whatever, if it's more difficult to bring goods in from outside to import stuff, then smaller businesses in Britain might actually stand a better chance of selling their stuff domestically.
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends what happens with the pound and with tariffs. So, I mean, if the pound crashes, then foreign fruit and veg will become more expensive, and certainly agriculture is one of the interesting areas. I mean, in the draft agreement, there's a lot more freedom to play around with agricultural subsidies than we had when we were a mainstream part of the EU. What appears to be the case is that agricultural subsidies can be set at an overall percentage level, but there won't be specifics about how we use those agricultural subsidies. So potentially we could use those much more to, you know, promote biodiversity, and to make sure that they're not going to the wealthiest of landowners. So there's an opportunity that's there.
Are you not already doing that?
It's doing it to some extent, but we would have much more latitude as a country than we've got at the moment within the EU.
Let's have a listen to Prime Minister's questions with Jeremy Corbyn, leader of the opposition, coming head to head with Theresa May on Brexit.
Mr. Speaker, Labour respects the result of the referendum, but what we don't respect is the shambolic mess that this government has made of negotiations. The mess they've created that they can't now get themselves out of. Yeah. We won't let them destroy this country's economy or the jobs and life chances of so many others. And Mr. Speaker, if the Brexit Secretary is still in office by the time the Cabinet meets this afternoon, could she take him on one side and have a quiet word with him and tell him that 10,000 lorries arrive at Dover every day, handling 17% of this country's entire trade in goods, estimated to be £122 billion last year. This woeful ignorance by a person in high office is disturbing to so many people. This government, Mr. Speaker, has spent 2 years negotiating a bad deal that will leave the country in an indefinite halfway house without a real say. Yet they think they can impose a false choice on Parliament between a half-baked deal or no deal, when a sensible alternative plan could bring together Parliament and the country. Even Conservative MPs say the Prime Minister is offering a choice between the worst of all worlds and a catastrophic series of consequences. When will the Prime Minister recognise that neither of these options is acceptable?
The Right Honourable Gentleman talks about woeful ignorance. I'll tell him where the woeful ignorance lies. It lies on a Labour Party front bench that thinks you can build a better economy by spending £1,000 billion more, putting up people's taxes and destroying jobs. The real threat to jobs and growth in this country sits on the Labour Party front bench. And I'll tell him what we're delivering in relation to Brexit. He says, what about Brexit? Yes, I'll tell him what we're delivering on Brexit. We will not rerun the referendum. We will not renege on the decision of the British people. We will leave the customs union, we will leave the common fisheries policy, we will leave the common agricultural policy, and we will take back control of our money, laws and borders. We will deliver Brexit, and the United Kingdom is leaving the European Union on the 29th of March 2019.
taking back control of money. Hang on, I thought that's something we had control of already. But anyway, Martin, what do you make of that exchange there?
Well, I mean, the trenches are being dug, aren't they? As I understand it, the Labour Party's position is that they're going to vote, and this includes the Blairites, because they're facing deselection if they don't vote against the government on this. The Labour Party grassroots see this as an attempt, as an opportunity to force the Tories out, to have a general election, which could then lead to a coalition government, for example, which might bring in a sensible electoral system, which we could then start to go back to the European Union and say, look, let's have another chat about this. The main problem from my point of view with this deal is that the customs union thing is time limited, which of course the Irish backstop was to make sure that Northern Ireland always remains within a customs union, which the DUP don't like, even though they lost the vote on Brexit in the six counties, which of course is a very, you know, this question about sovereignty and who runs what country and who gets to vote in what elections, it's a messy business. Ask them in West Belfast, ask them in Kosovo.
Well, that sounds like a threat.
I'm just saying, I mean, that's the business. Sovereignty is about that sort of thing, Tony.
I don't think there's any real likelihood of a return to violence.
Well, I think the real IRA have made it quite clear that they will regard any customs barriers
IRA?
Well, they're nobody. They're irrelevant, but they're still there. They still exist. And the potential for conflict hasn't gone away. So don't think that that's what sovereignty is all about, really, when it comes down to it.
Okay, so let's have a listen now to Peter Bone, who wasn't very impressed, Tory MP.
Mr. Peter Bone! Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Is the Prime Minister aware that if the media reports about the EU agreement are in any way accurate, you are not delivering the Brexit people voted for, and today you will lose the support of many Conservative MPs and millions of voters across the country?
Prime Minister! Can I say to my honourable friend?
Members must calm themselves. I've often advised taking some sort of soothing medicament and people may feel better in consequence. I want to hear what the Prime Minister has to say, and I hope the House has the courtesy to want to do so as well. The Prime Minister.
Can I say to my honourable friend that what we have been negotiating is a deal that does deliver on the vote of the British people. In the list that I set out earlier, I left out one of the things that the British people are very keen to see from this deal, which is an end to free movement, and we will ensure that we are delivering on that, as well as those other elements that I have set out. What we're doing is a deal that delivers on that vote, but in doing so protects jobs, protects the integrity of our United Kingdom, and protects the security of people in this country.
Well, there was also a question on, well, so many at Prime Minister's questions on Brexit. And by the way, the text hadn't even been released. It was released first by the European Commission on their website before it was released to us by the government here. So let's have a listen to what Arch Remainer Ken Clark had to say, also, of course, a Tory.
Mr. Kenneth Clark.
Mr. Speaker, at the moment we're in the middle of a swirl of rumours about the proposed deal with the European Union and a torrent of criticism from all the government's most ferocious critics. But one of the rumours is that if the Cabinet agrees the deal this afternoon, the government proposes later today to publish a white paper setting out the details. Will the Prime Minister give an assurance that if and when this deal is published, a statement will be made to this House of Commons when it is produced? Because it is this Parliament which is going to have to decide now what to do next, and we don't want Parliament only to be consulted after another 24 hours of rumours and criticism. We would re-establish parliamentary sovereignty, and I wish the Prime Minister well in obtaining a majority for some course of action in future which is in the national interest.
Well, actually, the Prime Minister just replied yes to him, pretty much. But he says an interesting sort of conundrum here, Jerome. I wonder what you make of it, which is, who is actually sovereign? The people that vote in a referendum or Parliament? Because they don't always agree. Do they?
Well, it's a bit of a mix. I mean, we've got parliamentary sovereignty rather than sovereignty by popular plebiscites or referendums. You know, we're not Switzerland, and when people voted in the referendum for Brexit, they weren't quite sure what they were getting, and they pretty much said to Parliament, get on with it and sort it out.
So, Martin, who is it? Who is actually in charge here? It's not the people, probably, is it?
I think the constitutional position, as a lawyer would tell you, is that the Queen in Parliament is sovereign. So, in other words, Parliament, and no Parliament can bind a future Parliament. That is the British Constitution in a nutshell. And so, if Parliament decided to have a No Deal Brexit, they could have it. If they decided to have this, they could have it. If they decided to go, you know, Parliament in theory is sovereign. But of course, as I pointed out earlier, Sinn Féin don't participate in our Parliament, but they do participate in the Irish Parliament. And if they turned up, there wouldn't be a Tory government and we wouldn't be talking about any of this.
Well, there is no parliament over in Northern Ireland at the moment.
No, there isn't one.
Actually...
No, I was talking about the parliament. I was talking about the Doyle.
Martin, I'm talking about the parliament in Northern Ireland, right? Now, that was actually part of the Good Friday Agreement, that should be back in place again. And yet, for 2 years now, there's been no parliament, has there, in Northern Ireland? This is actually... Yeah, surely another real serious problem. Why is there no parliament over there?
Because basically Sinn Féin do not want to participate in a government in Northern Ireland which carries through a cuts policy decided in London. So if they want to carry through a cuts policy in Northern Ireland, they've got to do it themselves. And they're not inclined... I mean, Vardaker, who's the Prime Minister of Ireland, suggested that Sinn Féin should turn up just once to vote the Tory government out. But they refuse to do it because it's not in their constitution. But if they did, then we wouldn't be talking about any of this. So that's what sovereignty means. It depends where you live. And of course, people are fighting for sovereignty all over the world. You know, it's a big issue. And it's not just to do with, voting in Brexit.
No, it isn't. And there is a big parliament. And it took place here just a couple of weeks ago here in Bristol. It's called the Parliament of Mayors. And just a couple of days ago, up on the Bristol City Council YouTube channel appeared this amazing promotional video featuring our very own mayor discussing what it was all about. Obviously, our council taxpayers' money is being spent on this global parliament of mayors. Actually, before we hear the clip, Jerome, what do you make of having that sort of event here? Mayors from all over the world coming to the UK.
I'm not opposed in principle, but I'm very interested to hear what the sort of practical outcomes from it have been.
Have there been any, do you know?
Not that I'm aware of.
It seems to be a lot of talking. But anyway, let's have a listen to Marvin and various other mayors chipping in here.
We believe that national governments working alone are just not equipped to cope with the world the way it is. It's moved on from what it was 50 years ago.
People don't live their lives in the nation. They live their lives in their communities. So when you have leaders come together, such as the mayors, it really creates a bridge for us to cross the gulf that has been created by world leaders who have abdicated their responsibilities.
If we fail on an issue like climate change, for example, we know we'll be flood prone. We will see more migrants coming to the north because there'll be millions of climate-driven migrants in the future. We'll be more prone to urban instability and sickness. So on any of the themes we talked about today, we just cannot afford to fail. The stakes are too high and mayors will be on the front end of that.
Mott MacDonald provides advice on multiple issues that affect people's lives. And the GPM has given us the opportunity to showcase that diversity of skills for a powerful global audience.
We're being seen and heard by the right people to be able to make this great technology a great part of big city landscapes.
Well, the event's been fantastic, but one of the highlights for me is just sitting in the chamber, listening to mayors introduce themselves from the whole range of countries, from Australia, United States, Uganda, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and listening to all those countries represented in Bristol City Hall has just been phenomenal. And just to share in that spirit of collaboration and desire to make the world a better place on behalf of the constituent cities, but also the whole world as well, has really been uplifting.
We're a worldwide effort, dare I say revolution.
Sounds like some sort of a revolutionary council, doesn't it? That chap at the end there saying. And also, they don't seem very interested in the whole idea of the nation state. They're interested in sort of supranational bodies, I imagine, like the United States and the EU, that sort of thing, Jerome.
I mean, I think where national governments have broken down, I mean, for example, the US response to climate change at a federal level with Trump is woeful. And what states in the US are able to do with the powers that they've got and cities are able to do can be quite impressive. I don't think we've got quite the same opportunity in the UK. We've got a much more centralised government, and my personal preference would be to see the mayor kind of focusing in on those areas for which he does have responsibility, rather than doing too much global networking.
How do you think Marvin's getting on after it's 2.5 years or 2 years or so since he was elected? He's halfway through.
I think he could be doing better. I mean, I think particularly on congestion in the city and public transport.
I thought the whole point was to bring in a congestion charge, so you need to have a lot of congestion if you want to do that.
What we want is free flowing traffic through the city with clean air, people able to get around in a way which is affordable, and I think it's really disappointing that we've seen two cabinet transport members under Marvin, and they've both gone, and he's now taken that portfolio back. And we haven't yet seen the clean air proposals. We've seen other cities moving ahead. And we had the transport committee here, the parliamentary transport committee here in the city on Monday, looking at Bristol Transport. And we've got James Freeman, the MD of First Bus, saying that it's impossible to get the buses to run on time with the number of cars clogging up the city centre at peak times. And really, we need a mayor who does something about that.
But surely First Bus are looking to blame anybody else except themselves. They haven't even got enough drivers for their buses.
You just need to be in the city centre at rush hour to see that it's cars that are holding up the buses. And if a bus is going at an average speed of 6 miles an hour during rush hour, you've got to reduce the number of cars that are there for people to be able to get around in the most efficient way.
I mean, has there been any real effort to persuade people to get out of their cars, leave them at home, maybe a free park and ride or something like that?
You know, park and rides are part of the solution, but the roads are clogged up with cars. And something needs to be done about that, and there needs to be, we need to have a mayor with the political courage to do something about that.
Which is what, a congestion charge?
Congestion charge is part of it, clearly, in order to meet the requirements for decent legal air quality, we need clean air zones where charging is involved as well. So, I mean, London has got a mixture of congestion charging and clean air zone charging. And as a city, we need to move towards something like that. So, you know, we've got 300 people a year dying because of poor air quality in the city. And, you know, we really need some action on that now.
Oh, it was that poster at the Bear Pit, wasn't there, that thousands and thousands of people used to see as they're driving round.
That's
James
right.
Barton roundabout that the I think it was Asher Craig at the City Council said take that down, and it was taken down by the Bristol Waste Company. So they don't like to admit these things. It's actually a bit of embarrassment there.
Absolutely, and you know, that's the sort of action that we want to see, you know, the mayor focusing more on.
Martin, what do you make of Marvin and his Global Parliament of Mayors? I didn't see any from places like Russia, for example.
Well, I'm not really a big fan of elected mayors anyway. I was never in favour of having elected mayors. I think the parliamentary way of doing business is the best way.
Well, cabinet government. There are supposed to be, I thought, mayors on that video. But no, we see one of the directors or executives of Mott MacDonald, who are management consultants, also sort of parading around amongst the mayors. So what are management consultants doing, sort of almost like pretending to be mayors at Martin's big event?
Well, I didn't know about this. Not Martin's event, Marvin's event.
Marvin's event, yeah, sorry.
Well, I think the whole idea of having elected mayors is very much a kind of gimmick.
Now, answer my question about Mott MacDonald. These are management consultants.
I don't know why they're there.
Why are they doing mingling with mayors, pretending to be mayors?
I would suggest you, and I would suggest this to George Ferguson the other week, the whole thing of elected mayors is a bit of a neoliberal scam, really, because if you want to get developers, for example, want to get stuff through, and you've got an elected mayor who hasn't actually really got a mandate, you only have to bend their ear to get what you want done. Whereas in the past, there would have been, when Ken Livingstone used to run the GLC, first of all, He was the leader of the GLC, and he had to get full agreement from his Labour cabinet to get anything through. And that's usually the way we've run things in this country for hundreds of years. And elected mayors, a bit like referendums, are a bit of a novelty.
Okay, well, let's get away from Marvin and from Brexit for a bit and talk about something a bit more real. This is from Prime Minister's Questions. It's about police cuts and the increase in violent crime.
Joan Ryan. Here.
Home Office documents, the Met Commissioner, the Police Federation, and now even the Home Secretary say the government's cuts to policing have had an impact on the surge in violent crime. We cannot continue to see the levels of violence which resulted in 5 fatal stabbings in 6 days in London just 2 weeks ago. How many times does the Prime Minister need to be told about the dire consequences before she gives our frontline policing the resources they so clearly need?
Prime Minister.
What can I say to the Honourable Lady that I'm sure we are all concerned across this House of the attacks that have taken place in recent days in London, but indeed we are concerned about the issue of knife crime and the serious violence that we've seen, and indeed we heard earlier from her Honourable friend the reference to the use of a crossbow in attacking and sadly killing an individual. She talks about police funding, though. We've protected police funding overall since 2015. We're putting more money into the police. We're making more money available. We've announced that. But it's also about ensuring that the police and the criminal justice system have the powers they need to deal with knife crime. And if she's concerned about knife crime, I suggest she asks her right honourable friend, the Leader of the Opposition, why he voted against increasing the powers to deal with knife crime.
Martin, what do you make of this? I know you've been maintaining for a while that there hasn't been an increase in knife crime. There has.
Well, I think there's the questions of why knife crime are increasing are very big questions. The question of whether the police are underfunded or not is a more straightforward question, because the answer to that is they are. What causes knife crime? Illegal drugs market causes all kinds of crime, and maybe we should legalise all drugs as I've often recommended. But those are big questions. The small question is the police haven't got enough resources to do their job, and we have people from the Police Federation on there and the Chief Constable who agreed with that the other week.
Should your niece or nephew be able to go down the sweet shop and buy heroin then?
No, I didn't say that, Tony, did I?
Well, what do you mean then?
Well, are we going to talk about drug criminalisation?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Why not?
Well, the fact of the matter is that López Obrador, who's been elected as president of Mexico and is taking office on January, they're definitely going to legalise marijuana, as Canada has done. And, of course, there's big pressure in Latin America for legalisation of all drugs, because 60,000 people died in drug-related violence in Brazil last year, which is one of the things that led to the election of Bolsonaro, the far-right candidate. And the problems we've got with knife crime in London pale into insignificance compared to what goes on in Chicago, where the Americans, of course, the Tories, want us to go down the route of being more like the United States of America. Well, that's what it looks like. And, of course, where we're going with a global crash and all the rest of it, the drug cartels propped up the banks in 2009. That's a UN report said that. The situation is actually quite dire. And I'm not saying it's not dire in London, but people need to wake up and smell the coffee out there in the real world, in the third world, where all these drugs are produced. People are dying every day and in much larger numbers.
Jerome, what do you make of any kind of link between the increase in violence and drug crime?
Going back to the rise in violence among young people, I'm at least as concerned about the decimation of the youth services, which give teenagers something to do.
Your mayor candidate is the boss of this, what's it called again?
Creative Youth Network.
Creative Youth Network, which apparently is just running all these as they used to be, these youth centres.
Well, I mean, I think that's great, but I mean, nationally, you've had massive cuts in youth services and ending of youth club facilities, and there isn't, you know, there's not enough for young people to do outside of school to steer them away to something more productive than, you know, the benefits of gang life.
There's also video games, and some saying nowadays that violence can be a form of entertainment for some young people. Is that stretching a point, Martin?
I think, leaving aside the question of legalisation of drugs, I think a lot of this particular kind of violence is to do with the way we're socialising certain young men in particular. And incidentally, of course, we haven't got anything like the problems they've got in London, in Bristol, thank goodness, touch wood, but let's not get carried away, because the potential's definitely there, and we've got to be very vigilant if we're going to put a stop to it. I don't think there's any easy answer. If one 14-year-old wants to stab another 14-year-old, it's actually really easy
Martin,
to do.
Martin, just in this week's Guardian, we've got a letter in there about crime. Knife crime, stop and search, and violence as entertainment. Jenny Jones says scrapping the requirement that police need reasonable grounds to carry out a stop and search would take us straight back to the era of the sus laws. While Val Honeyburn wonders at adults' preoccupations with simulated violence. Scrapping the requirement that police need reasonable grounds to carry out a stop and search would take us back to the era of sus, alienating whole communities but relying on the individual personal bias of officers. So what do you make of this idea of you know, there just doesn't seem to be any reason for young people not to carry knives nowadays if they're not going to be stopped and searched?
Well, the thing is, the problem is, I remember watching a programme about Chicago years ago, and they were talking to this 16-year-old lad, and he was carrying a gun. I said, why are you carrying a gun? He said, well, the guys on the other side of the town, or our nearest neighbours will shoot me if I don't. I said, well, aren't you worried the police are going to shoot you? He said, I'm much more scared of them than I am of the police. Now, you've got a situation now with gang culture where people are much more, these lads are much more scared of each other than they are of the police, and stop and search won't touch that. The fact is that if people are that alienated and that capable, the violence is actually very close to the surface. And knifing somebody is so easy. You just get a sharp object and you stick it in 2 inches and they're dead. And of course, if you're terrified of that, you will carry a knife because you think we've got to protect yourself and so on. We've got to do something to break this down. Youth clubs, obviously, but we also need to give them hope for a future and all the rest of it.
Isn't that, Jerome, isn't that the major part of it for a lot of young people? They just don't see any prospects in the job world. Many young people just, I mean, they may study, for example, get a degree, and then struggle to even get a job in a cafe or something.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, we do have pretty high levels of employment in the country at the moment.
I mean, hasn't this generation let the young people down, actually?
I think to some extent it's let the younger generation down, whether it's done more so than previous generations. I mean, when I became an adult, there were 3 million people unemployed, and we're not in that position now.
Martin, how is there any feasible way, you've been an economist, take a sort of longer view of this, to spend and actually get jobs, create jobs in this country?
Well, the fact of the matter is that the employment that people have got is very, very poor quality employment, and it's based on zero interest rates and quantitative easing, and sooner or later that's going to come to an end and we're going to have mass unemployment. And if we have mass unemployment plus gang culture plus illegal drugs market plus all the rest of it,
is it feasible to get back to a different situation with the jobs market where there's plenty of jobs for everyone?
It's not a question of jobs.
Is that just impossible?
Well, what we may have to do, as the Greens have been recommending for years, is move towards a universal income. Because as robotics comes in, lots of jobs which used to be for low-skilled people are going to disappear, and that's just
well,
inevitable.
Actually, the Italians are now talking about that, aren't they?
That's one of the things that puts them on a collision course with the European Central Bank.
It's interesting, isn't it? Why is it that the European Central Bank is saying no, you can't do that? Because it's actually be brilliant for their society.
Well, the thing is, what you've got is that the coalition between the Grillisti and the Five Star Movement is the Five Star Movement wanting a universal income, but the Grillisti want a flat tax. So at the same time as cutting taxes for the wealthy, they're promising poor people that they're going to give them a free handout, and I'm broadly in favour of it. But of course the ECB doesn't like it, because they're basically saying we're not going to stick by the rules of balancing the books. And that's the issue. We've got to change those rules so that people can actually invest for the future without being bossed around by the European Central Bank or by the currency markets.
Okay, before we hear from you on the universal basic income, Jerome, because I know it's a Green Party policy, I don't know, there's not really any chance of it happening in the near future, but at least you're talking about it. Let's have a listen back to Prime Minister's questions again, where we hear about why we need that sort of thing.
Ruth Smith! Speaker, over a third of children in my great city are currently living in poverty. Our local food banks have seen a 42% increase in demand since universal credit was imposed on us in June. Most referrals come from the Tory-led City Council, who are refusing to give them a penny. Is this compassionate conservatism?
No.
Say to the Honourable
Prime Minister.
She is well aware. We're introducing universal credit. The previous system of the benefit system we inherited from the Labour Party did not work. It left over a million people living on benefits, trapped in benefits for more than up to a decade. What we are doing is ensuring that people have more encouragement to get into the workplace, and when they're in the workplace, work always plays. And as I said, we have seen very good figures in the significant reduction in the number of children in workless households.
Well, what the Prime Minister's saying there is just a flat-out lie. It's that work doesn't pay. Actually, it's been proven in several studies now that work is no longer a route out of poverty. So, anyway, Ruth is from Stoke-on-Trent, Jerome. She's saying in just 5 months since they introduced universal credit, the use of food banks has gone up nearly 50%. So, anyway, what do you make of the...
I think the rollout of universal credit has been kind of pernicious in its effects, and it's not been carefully thought through, and we clearly need a sort of reworking of the world of welfare, and the Greens as well as sort of being very keen on the idea of sort of universal basic income, and more focused than any of the other parties on having a wealth tax. And in terms of the most serious problems, going back to what you're saying about meaningful lives for younger people, what we're seeing is increasing levels of wealth inequality, and wealth as well as income inequality needs to be dealt with, particularly with housing. Housing's the most obvious
apparently
area.
There's not enough money. Martin, would there be enough money for a universal basic income in Britain?
Well, I think there's been lots of studies done over the years, and don't forget, universal basic income was originally thought up as an idea by Milton Friedman, and he called it negative income tax. And I think the problem with the ideological power of capitalism is such that as long as it's kind of functioning, then nobody really wants to challenge the fundamentals. But if we have a crash, and of course there is going to be one, and it's going to be much worse than happened in 2008, we're going to have to rethink everything that we do
so
and the way we do it.
So you're saying something like a universal income might precipitate a crash? Doesn't
no,
sound
no.
Like
what, you'll need, what you'll need to do is rebuild the society after the end of the crash, or when the crash happens. The government is going to have to step in and take control of the situation.
Could a no deal, could a no deal Brexit precipitate that crash?
It could precipitate a crash for Britain, but the real problem is that there's a potential crash coming between the standoff between the Italians and the European Central Bank. There's a potential crash coming in the US, because if you look at the stock market in October and November, or around the world, in the BRICS are collapsing. You know, Argentina, Brazil, South Africa, Turkey, Ukraine's a basket case. The stock market in the US has taken a pretty much of a hammering this autumn, and at some point the trapdoor is going to open and we're going to go through the crash, because nothing's been done. We've had 10 years since the last crash and nothing's happened to solve the fundamental problems.
Jerome, Bristol is planning to become carbon neutral by 2030. Now, I've got quite a lot of carbon in me. Does that mean I've got to go?
No.
What does it mean, carbon neutral?
Well, I mean, I think if you go to the recent IPCC report, which says that we're on track to increase average global temperatures by more than 2°C, and they spelt out very clearly some of the awful consequences of what that looks like in terms of, for example, rise in sea levels, total collapse of sort of global coral, increasing levels of migration. It is a really serious emergency and kind of a really pressing challenge for our time.
Extinction of species as well.
Absolutely. And what we're looking to do as a city is to become carbon neutral by 2030 instead of 2050, and that will impact lots of different aspects of our lives. I mean, private car use is a very good example. I mean, if you're driving a car 10,000 miles a year, then that's 2 tons of carbon. That's about your total annual supply of what you would be allowed to generate in terms of carbon if you were going to be on track for a sort of less than 2°C warming. And food, the way we eat our food. George Mumbo in The Guardian said recently that need for agricultural land would be reduced by 76% if we move to a plant-based diet, with obviously fabulous impact, beneficial impact on the climate and on biodiversity, and on this sort of massive extinction of different species that we're seeing at the moment.
So is the mayor behind this?
The mayor is behind it in principle, but when it comes to some of the consequences in order to be able to move things forward, such as improving public transport, reducing car use, considering thoughtfully whether it's appropriate to expand Bristol Airport or not, we are very concerned.
Is the mayor behind a congestion charge? Because that would make quite a big difference, wouldn't it? I would suggest it's much better to persuade people to get onto alternative modes of transport rather than that. But that's another way.
You'd need to ask him that yourself.
I'm afraid. I've tried. I can't.
The Bristol Draft Transport Strategy has identified congestion as one of the biggest problems that the city faces in terms of its transport, and encouraging people onto the streets when the streets are so blocked with cars is very difficult.
Okay, another story which hasn't got a little bit of reporting this week. The Nazi in the British Army, an outstanding apparently corporal who served in Afghanistan, is jailed for preparing a race war and recruiting for neo-Nazi National Action. Seven others are convicted for belonging to the banned terror group. Corporal Mikko Vehiflanen, 34 years old, believed a race war was coming to the UK and he was recruiting for it, Martin.
Well, it's a sad thing to hear, but it seems that they've been caught and
he was jailed
and
in March. Yeah. We've only just been allowed to know about it. Well, it's funny because we hear lots and lots about Islamic terror, but when it's far right Nazi, we're not allowed to know.
There's been a huge lot of arrests in Germany in the army because they were planning to assassinate various left wing politicians and so on, but they've all been arrested, and hopefully that will be nipped
in Germany.
The
200, you're quite right. Yeah. A secret plot by 200 elite neo-Nazi soldiers within the German SAS to slaughter politicians and immigrants in a mission known as Day X was smashed after a former major went in and confessed. Now, this is pretty worrying, Jerome, to have Nazis in the army, but even more worrying is that it's not being reported until 5 months after the event.
Certainly sounds concerning, at the moment seems not as serious as the problem that they've got with right-wingers in the US.
Martin, do you think there's more of this to come out? And how come someone's been able to get away with this for such a long time, recruiting Nazis within the British Army?
Look, this is possibly for hour two, because there's a whole story about how all this stuff operates, as you well know. It's not just random people. The BND, the intelligence service in Germany, was run by Reinhard Gehlen after the war, and Reinhard Gehlen used to run the Gestapo, and that's why a lot of this stuff gets covered up.
To finish with another thing which has been pretty much covered up, we're going to play a little bit of it now. It's Iceland's advert, which has been banned. Iceland, the supermarket's advert for palm oil. We're going to hear a little bit from it now.
There's a human in my forest, and I don't know what to do. He destroyed all of our trees for your food and your shampoo. There's a human in my forest, and I don't know what to do. He took away my mother, and I'm scared he'll take me too.
Well, that goes on, but Jerome, this is pretty weird. Why have they banned this?
I didn't know it had been banned.
Yeah, but you can watch it on YouTube and on the internet, but nowhere else, Martin. It's crazy, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it's been banned because it's supposedly political. So Iceland have basically, pushed a sort of greeny message that they're opposed to palm oil, and then it's been banned because they can't do that because it's too political, which I think is pretty silly. I mean, Iceland have got a right to their stuff any way they like.
You know where to get your Christmas cakes, folks. Anyway, now time for the Murdoch News at 7. Thanks to our guest, Green Councillor of Clifton, Jerome Thomas. We'll be back after the news.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.